yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as we started last week, a review of the events, key events and developments in 2017, and I promised this week I would make some predictions for 2018, and we'll do so. But first, want to make a couple comments on two important events of the past week. One is the stock market reaches new record levels in the U.S., the Dow, the NASDAQ, and S&P 500, the three major stock indexes. Big headlines in the Wall Street Journal today and New York Times and elsewhere, business press saying, whoa, record. Yes. And it's the culmination of certain policies that have pumped incredible volume, magnitude of liquidity and income and money into the investor class, their corporations, their banks and their shadow banks. Never before have they been so flush with cash and earnings. And it goes on and on. And well, we're going to talk about that. What's driving the stock market this year up perhaps 30%, 25, 30% in 1 year? Is it a bubble? I believe we're in the middle of a bubble. We haven't reached the peak. Well, what defines a bubble in asset prices? There's no consensus on that. It just goes up too fast or too high or both. Well, how much is too fast and too high? Well, depends on, you know, what your definition is, quantitative. Oh, but very clearly, qualitatively, this is a bubble in progress. And what's driving it then, and how much longer will it continue? Well, we'll talk about that shortly here. And you should know it's not just a U.S. stock bubble, it's going on globally, because this is a global financial system. It's totally integrated, electronically, globally. The investors that drive up the stock market are the same investors who drive up the Japanese Nikkei market, right? Or the Hang Seng in Asia, or the Euro Stoxx 600 in Europe, or the FTSE in the UK, FTSE, FTSE. Or in emerging markets. It's going on everywhere because we've had a massive increase in the last decade of liquidity, i.e. money capital, investable money capital, readily investable, in the hands of the global financial elite. And they are moving the money around. Well, I talked about that in great detail in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, and predicted what's going on now. You see, we're in the later stages of the credit cycle, the capitalist credit cycle. And when that happens, you start getting a lot of froth. You start getting a lot of speculation. Bubbles begin to emerge. And the shift into financial price appreciating profits and markets accelerates. And that's exactly what's happening now. All right, so we'll get to that very shortly. I also want to talk about the other news event of the past week, the apparent rift between Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. What's behind this? Well, on the surface, you know, it says, you read the press and they're saying, well, you know, this guy Michael Wolff coming out with this book here, quotes Bannon, and Bannon says that Donald Trump Jr. meeting with the Russians is treasonous, and a couple of other things that are really anti-Trump. Well, why is Bannon saying that? Is he just PO'd because he got fired by Trump as a advisor. Well, what was behind that? What was behind that firing is also behind the firestorm now going on here publicly in this rift. And of course, Bannon is backtracking, is stumbling over himself as fast as he can. And well, let's talk about that shortly as well before we get on to the predictions. So, two things: stock market, what's driving the bubble, and the Bannon Trump rift, what's behind it, what's it all about, will it heal? No. And who come out on top? Well, guess who? Whoever has the backing of the big finance capital elite behind them, and that's right now Donald Trump, because he's delivering for them, you see. It's an example of how this elite and the backers of Trump, this new aggressive wing, finance wing of the capitalist class in this country, back Trump reluctantly at first, but they got the big tax cuts. They got trillions and trillions of dollars. And by the way, let me digress shortly. That trillions of dollars in tax cuts is not 1.5 trillion. That's just the deficit. And actually, that is a low, ultra low estimate, because it's based on assumptions of economic growth bringing in revenue, which are absurd. The deficit will be, oh, at least two plus trillion dollars, at least maybe three over the decade as a result of just these tax cuts. We're going to see once again trillion-dollar deficits because of the tax cuts and the increase in defense spending. And there'll be a war over cutting Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, education, etc. That's coming too, because they can't sustain those kind of deficits, and they're not going to give up their tax cuts or their war spending. No. So that fight is coming, and these tax cuts are trillions and trillions of dollars. When Trump ran, he said during the election he was proposing tax cuts of 5 to 6 trillion. Well, I believe the tax cuts are at least $5 trillion, and I'll explain why, and I'll be writing why here over the weekend. Print piece, just check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, for that piece on what the real value is of the tax cuts under Trump. You see, there's a lot of indirect cuts here that they're not even going to talk about, and consequences. They're only telling you the direct cuts, the Joint Committee on Taxation and Congressional Budget Office and so forth have their estimates, but that's a floor. You see, they're not factoring in other consequences of the tax cuts, which are just part of the tax cuts as well. And I'll be talking about that. So check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, next Monday, and you'll be able to see my analysis of why this tax cut is not 1.5 trillion. The tax cuts in the bill are 5 trillion, made up by 2 to 3 trillion in hikes on the middle class, which aren't the big investors, you see. In terms of net wealth, net worth, wealth, the median family households in the US, has fallen by a third since 2007. And it's not all their house prices declining, it's a decline in their savings. Okay. Well, we'll get back to the tax cuts. We've been talking about it a lot, but just to give the listeners a heads up here, check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, where you'll find an analysis of these tax cuts you won't find somewhere else. The true dimensions of these tax cuts. All right, so the tax cuts have something to do with the bubble, the stock bubbles. Let's turn and talk about the stock market bubbles, which are underway. U.S. All of them, and globally, in progress, hasn't reached their peak yet, will continue to rise throughout some period of 2018 before we have a major correction of 20 to 30%, which will precipitate the next recession. Okay, so what's driving the stock prices? The Dow in 2009 hit a low of 6,500. Now it's over 25,000. That's a 400% increase in stock prices, stock price appreciation. Well, stock prices are driven by, similarly to all prices, supply and demand. And in this case, when you have bubbles, it's always accelerating excess demand for the financial asset, in this case, the stocks. But it's the same thing when, foreign currency, Forex, with derivatives. It's the same thing with bonds and junk bonds. It's the same thing with cryptocurrencies. It's demand and supply. And in this case, when you have bubbles in financial markets, it's always demand grossly outrunning supply. So what's driving demand for stock prices or for stocks in general? Well, they're short-term drivers. By short-term, we mean things that are happening 1 year or less. And then there's long-term, more fundamental drivers. And there's determinants when we say drivers of stock prices. Well, let's look at those briefly. What are the short-term drivers behind the U.S. stock market bubble? All right. Well, in the past year, it was expectations and then the delivery, the realization of multi-trillion dollar tax cuts going to corporations and investors' bottom lines. Estimates are that 10 to 30% windfall in corporate profits will result from this tax cut. 10 to 30%. Wouldn't you like to get a 10 to 30% raise? Well, that's what corporations are going to get. Well, no wonder they're apoplectic, right? They're in nirvana. They're in corporate heaven. They don't have to do anything and they're going to get a 10 to 30% increase. Whoa. Pretty good. Well, on the face value of the tax cuts, $1.5 trillion tax cuts to corporations, and then another half a trillion, almost 0.75 trillion pass-through income increases. In other words, if you're not, you're a business, you're a capitalist, but you're not a corporate capitalist, right? 80% of all the businesses in the U.S. are non-corporate. They're going to get almost $1 trillion through the pass-throughs. And then these individual investors, and it's really the 5%, the wealthiest households that do the hold most of the stocks and the investments, And these figures that they give you about, oh, well, average median family America has stocks and so forth, well, it may be that their 401k plan has invested in something for them, but they're not active investors. And even that's a small percentage. All of these individual investors will not only benefit from the pass-through rate collapse, right? Big collapse from 39.6% to, I think it's 25%. I believe that's the latest with the Senate House resolution. Well, they're also going to get a bigger deal with the reduction in the hit from AMT, alternative minimum tax, bigger exemptions for the estate taxes, the top rate, individual rate cut as well. They get to keep the corporate, corporations get to keep their loopholes, inversion loopholes, carried interest loopholes, and they get to charge against any of the effects, cost effects here. You hear a lot about, oh, well, these oil companies, $1.5 trillion, and Apple, gonna a billion rather, and Apple's gonna have to pay more, and they're gonna take charges against the tax cuts. It makes it look like, oh, they're gonna have to pay. Well, they're not paying anything. It's all on paper. Ah, but the paper charges, the cost of that charge can be deducted from future taxes. So the charge makes it look like in the media and the press that you have to pay something. It's really a tax cut, indirect. And big new loopholes, no territorial tax, repatriation, boondoggle at 10% or 15%, which is only for cash. So they reconvert this cash offshore into other kind of assets, move them around, and they won't have to pay it. And you're going to see big continued increase in buybacks and dividends. Okay, so corporations, short-term driver of the stock market, a big 10 to 30% corporate tax windfall. Individuals get big tax cuts here if you're wealthy individuals. And a consequence of the corporate tax cuts is going to be more buybacks and dividend payouts to individual investors. Well, with more money capital on hand, corporations, and more buybacks and dividends on hand for individual investors, it's going to go right back into the stock market. Not all of it, but a good part of it, and it's such a large magnitude and volume, it's going to be significant. Hey, buybacks and dividend payouts since 2009, $1 trillion every year. The corporations are passing this through. You cut corporate taxes, they get to pass more through, you see. You lower interest rates, they get to issue more corporate bonds and use that low cost, virtually no cost corporate bond issuance to buy back stocks and pay out dividends. So the tax cuts are going to continue this trend of $1 trillion a year buyback and dividend payout boondoggle that's been going on. So big corporate tax cuts and buybacks and dividends, and individuals get to keep more money, invest in the stock market as well, and corporations will funnel some of that. They won't be all stock buybacks and dividends. They will use some of that to invest in financial markets, including U.S. stock markets as well. Okay, so that's driving all that extra liquidity is around the corner, expected and now being delivered, is driving demand for stocks. Now, there are other short-term drivers as well. The stock cut, I mean, the tax cuts are just one. Expectations of it, as well as now the delivery of the tax cuts. Well, we got the global economy that seems to be doing a little better. Well, it's mostly been driven by China. China, in anticipation of the Communist Party conference, opened up all the spigots and boosted its economy. They wanted robust growth, no slowdown before Xi did, before the conference. Ah, but now they're already signaling, in fact, before the conference started signaling, well, you know, too much speculation going on here in China by shadow bankers in China. They've been battling that problem with their shadow bankers for years, at least 5 years now, and going through a kind of a whack-a-mole policy shift. They boost the economy and boost liquidity, and to get growth going, some of it goes into growth, but some of it also goes into financial speculation in stocks and property values and asset, wealth management products and so forth, causing bubbles in China, right? And then the Chinese government says, "Well, you know, the shadow bankers and speculators are running amok. We got to bring them under control," and they tighten up the money supply. And in doing that, they slow the economy, but they corral a little bit the speculators. Well, they've been going back and forth, because as the economy slows too much, they say, "Oh, you know, we got to keep it going again." So they pump it in, and there go the speculators once again. So, you know, that on again, off again has been going on in China for 5 years. But in the past year, in expectation of the party conference, they've boosted the economy, boosted liquidity. There's over $5 trillion in non-performing loans in China. Big problem. But they've been able to control it, at least for a while now. And, you know, now they're shifting again. People's Bank of China Central Bank Chairman there, Zhu, outgoing, signaled a shot across the bar that, oh, you know, we may have a Minsky moment approaching here. In other words, Minsky, this economist who predicted financial bubbles and crises, And that was a signal that, okay, they're going to crack down on the growth funneled, financed by this massive increase in liquidity by the banks in China and foreign sources. And that means the shift now has occurred to slower growth in China. So that growth that has boosted the global economy is now going to disappear. And in the meantime, though, the figures show that the global economy is doing pretty good. Of course, those figures are always overestimated. The International Monetary Fund and Bank of International Settlements and the World Bank and OECD and so forth, they always grossly overestimate global economic growth. That's been going on. And then they for at least since 2008, and then a year or two later they reduce the amount that they predicted. They're always overly optimistic, and but it's true they get a little global growth going on. And that, of course, it has been a signal to stock investors to invest, and they have. There are other short-term drivers in the stock market. One is the low U.S. dollar policy. You see, the U.S. has kept the dollar lower relative to other major currencies in the world, and that's to benefit U.S. multinational corporations, you see, in their offshore operations. The profits they make offshore in those currencies, offshore currencies, they then convert to a lower dollar, and they make more dollars out of it, and then they bring the dollars back, if they bring it back. So multinational corporations love the low dollar, and it's been a low dollar policy for a long time, driven in part by the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates very low. You see, there's a relationship between the interest rates and the dollar. Rates rise, the dollar rises. Rates fall, the dollar falls. Well, we've had super low rates for 7 years, from 2008 to 16, and that kept the dollar very low. And the dollar is still low, even though rates are going up a little bit, short-term rates by the Fed. It's still very low because other rates are rising. Other currencies are rising. Okay, so foreign demand for U.S. stocks is driving some of the stock market. Well, how is that? Foreign demand for U.S. stocks? Well, if your currency is worth more than the dollar in exchange, you have to buy U.S. dollars. And if you can buy more U.S. dollars for your currency, that's a gain. And then you invest it in U.S. stocks. You invest the dollars in U.S. stocks. So, that's one of the things that's driving. Foreign demand is driving it as well, the stock market. Well, there's other things too that are driving the stock market, and that's structural shifts occurring in the markets themselves. We see this move to exchange-traded funds, ETFs. That's driving some of the demand, and a shift towards indexing and passive investing in stocks. That's shifting demand as well. Shifting it up, in other words, as long as demand is rising, the move to indexing, passive investing in ETFs drives the price even further. Of course, on the way down, ETFs and indexing is going to drive the decline even faster. That's a big problem looming on the horizon. When the next correction comes, it could be even bigger and faster, and a lot of small investors are going to get stuck because the prices will collapse even faster. Well, okay, so the short-term drivers, demand drivers of the stock market bubble going on today are the huge windfall from the tax cuts, the global economy appearing to recover a little bit, the low U.S. dollar, which still continues, even though the Fed is raising short-term rates, and structural changes. But those are short-term drivers, not insignificant, but short-term. Long-term, the drivers are the massive increase by the central bank, the Fed, and other major central banks of liquidity. In other words, money injections into the economy. QE, quantitative easing, as I've said many times, $4.5 trillion in the U.S., really $6 trillion when you count refinancing of bonds. And then in Europe, $5 trillion, in Japan, $5 trillion, nearly $1 trillion in the UK, and over $5 trillion, $6 trillion in China. $25 trillion or dollar equivalents being injected into the global economy. Excess, far more than is needed to invest in real assets, in other words, real things, plant, equipment, facilities, etc. Far more liquidity than necessary. And of course, all that liquidity stimulates financial asset markets and greater profitability, which causes then a shift away from real investment and into financial asset investment. That's been going on. That was a major theme in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility of the Global Economy, chapters on the financial asset shift and on shadow banks globally behind this. And then, of course, the most recent book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, is about how this fundamental shift was really and continues to be fed by the central banks. You see, subsidization of capital incomes and corporate profits is the main theme of 21st century global capitalism. State subsidization of capital incomes through monetary policy, and when that runs its course, a shift to fiscal policy. And now we see that shift underway with Trump as the Fed tries to raise rates. It can only raise short-term rates, and it can't raise them very much now because the system is so fragile. As I've said many times, it won't be able to raise it very far, much more. Maybe a half or 1 more percent in the federal funds rate. That's it. Once you get where are we at 1.5 federal funds rate, short-term interest rate by the central bank, the Fed. Okay, so the Fed says it's going to raise it 3 more times in 2018, 2 more times in 2019. Will never happen. They can't, right? Because once they do raise it a little bit beyond 2%, it'll cause a crisis in emerging and global financial and economy markets, and therefore impact U.S. multinational corporations negatively in terms of their profits. And of course, it will slow down the U.S. economy as well. Well, they can't raise interest rates very much more, That's why they are at the end of their ropes, as I say in the book. Ah, but they still have a lot they can do with fiscal policy, tax cutting, and they will continue that. All right. So, the long-term drivers is this massive increase in the U.S. over $10 trillion. When you look at all the ways that they've injected money into the economy under Bernanke and Yellen, over $10 trillion, probably. Zero interest rate policy. 0.1% for 7 years, right? That zero interest rate policy has enabled corporations to issue record corporate debt. In other words, issue corporate bonds because it's very low cost. Interest rates are very low. And they take that money and then they distribute it in buybacks and dividends, and that boosts the stock market, you see. That's been going on at least since 2008, 2009, and it's resulted in a major run-up in U.S. corporate debt. Now, you can keep paying your corporate debt, principal and interest, as long as your income flows increase and the prices of your whatever you're selling increase. But once that stops, whoa, then you're in trouble because then you have no cash flow, no income in order to pay the debt, which doesn't go away. See, then you got a crisis on your hands. Okay, but for now they keep raising their corporate debt. Household debt today is higher than it was in 2007. All the major forms, student debt, auto debt, credit card debt, over $1 trillion. So the U.S. households are deep in debt. Corporations have record level of debt, and the government, U.S. federal government, debt has more than doubled from 9 trillion to 20 trillion. Made possible by their own low interest rates. You see, they just keep financing the debt because it's cheap. Well, now the debt's not going to be so cheap to finance. And why are they financing the debt? Why has the debt increased from 9 to 20 trillion? Well, I've written about that. Check out my blog, jackerasmus.com. But it's mostly tax cuts and war spending and slow growth and boondoggles to the pharmaceutical companies and others. Okay, so longer term drivers of the stock is this stock market, so this massive $20-25 trillion increase globally in liquidity. And that's only since 2008. Before that, we had the US Central Bank pumping excess liquidity into the economy. We call that the Greenspan put, right? Then Alan Greenspan, the head of the Fed from 86 to 2006, pumping money into excess money into the economy, U.S. economy, global economy. And then Bernanke continued that policy and then accelerated the policy, the super put under Bernanke and Yellen. So long-term drivers are this 30, 40-year massive increase in liquidity, money, capital, pumped into the economies by the central banks and followed since 1999 by the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Bank of Japan, and People's Bank of China, especially after 2012 in Europe and their double-dip recession then. Okay, so monetary policy long run has been the basis for this. But we have also the tax cut, the fiscal policy that's also driving this huge increase in disposable, investable liquid money capital by the investor class and their corporations. Reagan, major tax cuts in the early 1980s, did that. Clinton carried on the tradition. 1997, big cuts in capital gains and dividends. Few crumbs to the households in terms of education credits and so forth. But major development under Clinton was what? He said the U.S. multinational corporations didn't have to pay taxes if they didn't want to offshore. A provision introduced called check the box for corporate tax returns. In other words, they just checked the box and said, okay, we got money offshore, but we're not going to bring it back this year. And they just kept doing that. And the money just kept accumulating. Well, that was a big incentive for companies to move offshore, wasn't it? Big incentive. Had a lot to do with the destruction of jobs in the U.S. and continues. That was the Clinton tax cuts, big boondoggle for multinational corporations, 1997. Then Bush comes along in 2001-3. Gives $3.4 trillion for a decade in tax cuts. Again, adopting the Clinton model, throws a few crumbs at households, but 80% of it goes to the wealthiest households. 2.156 trillion over the decade. In 2004, introduces even more tax cuts for energy and oil companies. And in 2005, introduces the repatriation tax boondoggle that we've seen replicated here under Trump, where if you guys bring back, you multinationals, bring back some of your money hoard offshore and invest it in jobs in the U.S., you get to pay a 5.25% tax rate instead of 35 at the time in 2005. Well, they brought back hundreds of billions, but they didn't create jobs. Studies now show that 90% of the money brought back in 2005 and 6 and after went to buy back stocks to pay out dividends and acquire their competitors, mergers and acquisitions. 90%. And that's what's going to happen again this time, in even greater dimensions. I estimate $500 billion in tax savings for multinational corporations as a result of the Trump tax bill. Okay, so that was George Bush, $2 to $3 trillion. in tax cuts. Obama comes along, $300 billion in the 2009 so-called recovery plan. $300 billion mostly going to businesses. We got virtually no recovery. So in 2010, at the end of 2010, another $800 billion he gives them. And then he extends the Bush tax cuts 2 more years. These expired in 2011, but he extends them in 11 and 12 at a cost of $450 billion each year. So that's another $900 billion. And then in 2013, he extends the Bush tax cuts for another decade, called the fiscal cliff settlement, for for $5 trillion. So, we get at least $3 trillion under Bush in tax cuts going to wealthy corporations and investors and businesses and households. And then we get $7 trillion under Obama going to the same. And then Trump, of course, as I said, now we're in the midst of yet another $5 trillion direct, indirect handout to corporations, investors, and the wealthiest 5% households. Well, this is a massive cut, and therefore enabling investors and corporations to keep more income. Well, what are they going to do with that income? Well, they partly hoard it, they sit on it, or they send it offshore to emerging markets, financial and real asset, or they use it for stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That's what they're doing with this, and they're going to do it again. Massive subsidization by the state, in this case, and tax cuts by the government, the Congress, and the president of corporate and investor incomes. Massive. Trillions, trillions. On top of the trillions enabled by subsidizing the same corporate, individual, investor, finance, capital through the central bank monetary system, monetary policy, fiscal policy, truly multi-trillion dollar subsidization going on. And all that excess liquidity and money is driving the stock market. It's not hard to figure out. In the US, at least 10 trillion monetary policy, 10 trillion fiscal policy, and you see it in the central bank buying up bad assets, giving cash to those who investors who made bad bets. That was QE. And then you see it in tripling of corporate profits and pass-through income, $2-3 trillion last decade. $7 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. 400% increase in the Dow, and that associated value results in more margin buying. And that drives the stock market too. So $6 trillion in direct QE and indirect monetary policy, $7 trillion in buybacks and dividends, trillions more in stock price appreciation and margin buying, and trillions as a result of low dollar and foreign demand for stocks, $15 trillion. Well, how can you pump $15 trillion into financial markets or put it in the pockets of the wealthy and the rich and not have them invest in financial assets? That's it, right? That's why the stock market will continue to go higher here, and we'll see what the consequence of that will be. It can't go high forever. At some point, the psychology is going to shift. Some big boys are going to say, well, the game is over temporarily here, and let's take our money and run. And when that happens, the psychology will shift, and the contagion will begin across different financial asset markets. Which ones? Well, who knows? And who knows exactly when? But you can bet not later than 2020, maybe 2019. That's what's going to happen. Where will it precipitate? In other words, when you talk about causation, you've got to talk about, fundamental causes. Fundamental causes are this massive liquidity and tax cut injection of capital incomes going on. That's why 95% of all the income gains since 2008 have gone to the wealthiest 1% households. 95%. Yeah, that's not my figure. That's Professor Emmanuel Saez at UC Berkeley, ELSA database. Check it out. 95% income inequality, and now we're giving them even more. And they have tripled their profits, and we're giving them 10 to 30% increase in profits, windfall with the tax cuts. They've tripled their profits. At the same time, they've slowed their real asset investment. That's why we got productivity so low, and that's one of the reasons why we got no wage increases. Businesses aren't going to give wage increases when productivity is slow, because that means their costs are rising because of slow productivity. They're not going to raise their costs even more by giving wage increases. No. In fact, they're going to cut wages. They're going to take it out of wages. Okay. So we'll watch this bubble here as it continues throughout the year. But at some point, the psychology will shift and the contagion will accelerate, and asset prices will correct 20 to 30% at minimum. And then we'll see what the impact that will be on the real economy in terms of layoffs and so forth. Okay. Let's turn now to what's behind the Bannon-Trump rift. Bannon clearly is distancing himself from Trump, or tried to. Does he know something about the Russia connection? Look, Trump is a wheeler dealer, commercial property finance capitalist. And all these guys are crooks, all of them. You want to deal in commercial property and housing and so forth, especially commercial property? They're all on the edge of criminality, people who play in that particular market. And he is too. Look, globally, he cut so many deals, I'm sure, with the Russian oligarchs before running for office, that there is a huge record here, of course, that the Russians are sitting on, but they'll leak it probably at some point. Of this guy's wheeling, dealing, and illegal activities before he ran for office. And they know it. Well, so does Bannon. And I think Bannon, in the quotes he made, well, what was the major quote? I haven't read the book by Michael Wolff yet, but apparently, according to the press, Bannon said that Trump Jr. meeting with the Russians was treasonous. Whoa. Mr. Big Eagle Donald sent him through the roof when he heard that. And I'm sure he got on the phone to his big finance backers, like the Mercers and the Adelsons and so forth, and said, "Hey, what are you going to do about this guy, Bannon? You had me move him out of the White House. But now, this is too far. What are you going to do about him?" Well, what are the Mercers doing about him? Well, they made it very clear that Bannon's on their SHIT list. I predict Bannon's going to get fired from Breitbart. Oh, well, Bannon, feeling the pressure here. Well, how would he get fired from Breitbart? Because the Mercers are financing Breitbart. And the Adelsons and all these finance capitalists, to whom these politicians, when they run, they make their pilgrimages and genuflect before them and ask them for money and support. They all do that. Rubio, all of them. They all go to the Adelsons, they go to the Mercers, they go to all these other guys, and they tell them what they're going to do, and hat in hand. Give me some money, for my campaign. I'll do whatever you want. These are the guys who control the show. And it's the Mercers and others who finance Breitbart News, not Bannon. Bannon may be the chair, but they'll drive him out. Well, Bannon, feeling the heat, said, "Oh, well, Trump was a great man." And then Trump comes back and tweets, well, he finally realizes that, sort of a enjoying the fact that he got the Mercers to and Breitbart to slap Bannon's knuckles here, wrap him on the knuckles and get him to retreat, right? Look, what this means is that these guys, these big finance capital elite guys who are funding behind the Koch brothers and all of them, funding behind the scenes, simply use this right populism of Bannon and others, Breitbart, to get into office, to give themselves the tax cuts and the trade deals and whatever else they want. And now they got what they want. They'll break. They'll break with Bannon. Bannon will be marginalized, and some other guru at Breitbart will become, the main guy, the main man, right? The lieutenant, the capo, right? For them, the political capo, to use a mafia term for a right-hand man there, right? Somehow replace them. You can see it. You can see the same phenomenon with all these talk show, right-wing talk show hosts, they do the bidding, on the networks, the Fox networks and the Clear Channel radio network and so forth. They do their bidding for them. And if they get too big ahead and they step out behind themselves, go beyond themselves, well, then they just fire them and put another face there that'll talk the same. And several of them have been gone down that route, right? So many, I forget their names. Well, it just shows you who really running behind this right populism, financing Breitbart and all these other groups and so forth. It's the big boys, the big money bags. And now that they've gotten their tax cuts and they got Trump going in the direction they want on free trade here, right? And they got the massive deregulation they want and a few other things that they want. It's been delivered. We don't need you guys. We don't need you, Bannon, anymore. And they'll do the same with Trump if the heat gets too hot. Okay, so that's my take on the Bannon rift here, and what that all means, and on the stock market boom. Let's go back to what we were talking about here in the previous shows here last week on the major events of 2017 and my predictions. I want to get on to my predictions here. Okay, so last week we talked about some of the major events of the past year, particularly Trump policies. I'm not going to repeat those. Just listen to last week's show. I spent a lot of time on the consequences of Trump and Trump policies. I talked about the U.S. economy in 2017, trends in GDP, what's behind it, productivity trends, the so-called wages conundrum, why wages weren't rising. Talked about the Bitcoin crypto bubble, another major development of last year. Talk about the Fed apparently making a shift, saying it's going to sell off their balance sheets and raise rates. The yield curve. Talked about that, inverting, and that's an important development. What's the yield curve? Well, the yield curve is the spread between short-term and long-term bonds and rates. Okay, typically it's the two-year federal government treasury rate and the 10-year. The 10-year, the longer the bond, the higher the rate tends to be. When the two rates converge, it's a signal. When the yield curve inverts, as they say, the 10-year or the long bond becomes the rate becomes less expensive than the short-term bond rate. That always has signaled recession. Never fails. Well, why? Because it's a representative of the Federal Reserve raising short-term rates, which it can, but the market's saying, oh, the economy is weaker. The Fed raises the short-term rates because it says, well, the economy is doing strong. It's doing well. Let's raise interest rates to cool it down. But if long-term rates are declining, then the markets and investors say, no, things aren't as good as they seem. And it's weaker out there, the economy is weaker, so long-term rates go down. Long-term being 10-year, 30-year, et cetera, long-term rates. And you get a convergence as a result. Well, over the past year, this curve has been drifting towards inversion. Right now, the 10-year bond versus 30-year bond is only one-third of 1% difference between them, or as they say, 33 basis points, 100 basis points for 1%. The 2 and the 10-year is about 50 basis points, and they are both moving in the direction of convergence. Well, my prediction is that the yield curve will converge and invert in 2018, early 2019. Another prediction I have is that the Fed will not raise interest rates more than 3 times this year in 2018. As I said many times and in my book, Systemic Fragility, and again in Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, the Fed cannot raise short-term rates much above 2, 2.25. That's maybe two more increases. That's it. Why? Well, it can't raise it because we have a change in global capitalism in the 21st century, and that is business activity is increasingly sensitive to increases in rate hikes, and increasingly insensitive to declines. You can lower rates, it takes a long time, lower them, sometimes they even have to go negative before you have an effect on stimulating the economy, but it doesn't take much to raise rates to reverse that stimulation. This is a change, and that's why monetary policy is increasingly ineffective as far as stimulating the economy is concerned. It's very effective in terms of subsidizing capital incomes, but not in stimulating real investment in the real economy. So you're not going to get much more of an increase in rates this coming year. Prediction, the new Fed Chair Powell replacing Yellen will not change policy. Okay. They do not mess with the Fed chairman because that's their the capitalist corporations, their number one safety valve when they have losses. Okay, continuity, stability there. Number three prediction, as I've been saying for some time, the auto market, the housing market, and the retail market will all slow in 2018. We're already seeing that. Autos, you know, I predicted that last summer, and then you got a little bit of boost because they were desperate and they gave massive discounts. But now autos are going to really slow here in 2018, that sector of the economy. As the rates go up, housing starts are going to already, we see the softness there, and retail. Well, saying, oh, you know, Christmas sales have been up. Well, they're up at Macy's and Penny's and places like that because Sears and others are collapsing. So the sales are going to Penny's and Macy's, but net, it's stagnant at best. And people are consuming not based on wage income increases, but based on debt and pulling money out of their savings. Okay, so recession in 2019. And the dollar will not rise very much because the rates will not rise very much either. The stock market will correct 20% plus by 2019, maybe even late 2018. The multinational corporations, the big companies, will continue their buyback dividend binge after the Trump tax cuts and mergers and acquisitions binge. Health insurance costs will again reach double-digit annual rates of increase, led by premiums. This is not just for ACA, Obamacare, but in general, premium hikes. And the drug companies will continue their price gouging. No one's doing anything about it. They're killing people. Drug companies have killed more people. Drugs and cigarette companies, tobacco companies have killed more people than any of the world wars the U.S. has been in. Okay, here's one for you. Trump will fire Mueller.
Yeah.
And there will be no special prosecutor. Already, you can see the rallying in Republican ranks against their own FBI. Ooh, this is significant. This is part of the war between the two segments of the ruling elites in this country. Okay? The Democratic Party will fail to retake the Senate in 2018. They will cut a deal on DACA, the Dreamers. They'll have a really DACA-lite solution in exchange for financing the wall, which will be a partial wall. But Trump will say, oh, it's the wall.
Okay. You're going to see an attack on unions by the Supreme Court. Dues checkoff and a number of other areas, increasing right to work movements everywhere. And unions are going to take it, continue to take it in the ear. You know, they wonder why we don't get wage increases when we get economic recovery, because you need a institution, a vehicle for recouping the wages you lost during recession. It used to be the unions. Unions are virtually gone, except in the public sector, maybe. Just a shadow of themselves. Well, there's no one to go after wage increases for wage earners. Okay, last few minutes here. What's going to happen the rest of the world? Prediction, UK will be in a recession. China's economy will slow. Nationalisms in Europe will increase. Already Lombardy, Northern Europe, Catalonia will continue to fester. Eastern Europe, Austria, and other places, we're going to see the same events here. The five-star movement will win the election in Italy, I predict. And that will give a big boost to this tendency for nationalisms, populisms, you know, in Europe. U.S.-Russia relations will worsen. The Ukraine war will heat up significantly. U.S. and China will continue drifting towards a trade war. And we will see a regulation of cryptocurrencies, bitcoins, and others in the coming year. And that will put a big damper on cryptocurrency prices and initial coin offerings and so forth, right? Which is just another reflection of this financial bubble frothing going on, which is really being driven by Europe in Asia, by the way. And Asia will continue dollarizing its debt, which is a big risk. And we're going to see more cryptocurrencies and so forth. Half of the buying is being driven in Japan and elsewhere in Asia. And that could destabilize the economy over there, not here. So these are the major predictions I have economically and a few politically going forward into 2018. And once again, take a read on my blog, jackrasmus.com, if you want to get my deep analysis of the true dimensions of this smash and grab Trump tax cut, which is just part of a 30-40-year tradition of subsidizing through tax cuts the corporate elite and their institutions. And it goes hand in hand with the central bank subsidizing capital incomes. And the thing about the 21st century neoliberalism is that this subsidization has intensified. They're giving more and more at the expense of the rest of us, more and more. Well, that's 2018. And next week, we'll have something interesting, I'm sure. This is Jack Rasmus.